A sleep expert from the Illinois Neurological Society has this advice for getting a good night's rest.
Your bed should be for sleep or intimacy. I tell all my patients, if you're not sleeping or getting lucky, get out of bed. No telephone, no laptop, no television, no lying awake thinking about the meaning of the universe. Those should all be done outside of your bed.
Dr. Sarah Zalek joins us to discuss the importance of sleep for our daily living and overall health. Plus, new research from the University of Illinois finds that some kids could have picky eating built into their genes.
Can we change or can we alter a children's eating behaviors even though, from a biological standpoint, they're more predisposed to hate certain foods?
But first, nearly 9 million children in the U.S. receive health insurance through the CHIP program, but federal funding is set to expire at the end of the week. What will happen if Congress doesn't act soon? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo. There's been a lot of talk about health care in the news this week, with lawmakers working on the latest attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. While that's been going on, there's actually another federal health care program that's at risk that has not been getting nearly as much attention. It's a program that provides health care to 9 million children across the U.S., and if Congress doesn't act soon, federal funding of that program will expire. It's known as the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, and it covers children in lower and middle-class families. What would this mean for children in Illinois? I spoke with two people Monday afternoon to help us learn more. Jenny Pinkwater is the executive director of the Illinois chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Jenny, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Debbie McCarroll is a senior policy analyst with Illinois Collaboration on Youth, a group that advocates for children, youth, and families. Debbie, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
So, Jenny, I'll start with you. Can you help us understand a bit more about the CHIP program? Who is it served? What's happening with CHIP here in Illinois?
Sure. So CHIP is a really important insurance program, not only in Illinois, but across the United States. It really serves as a bridge between Medicaid and private insurance or employer insurance. So, you know, there's many folks that are working jobs that are maybe in between jobs that don't make low enough salary to be able to qualify for Medicaid, but also make too little to afford their employee insurance. So CHIP is really the place that serves these children and allows them to access insurance through, in Illinois, what is known as All Kids. So it's a seamless program here in Illinois through Medicaid and CHIP. And so it serves a really important bridge for those to be able to continue to access care. It's certainly one of the main policy components federally and within the state that really drive our insurance rate down to around 4% for children in Illinois.
Got it. So, Debbie, how does the CHIP program fit in with the Medicaid program here in Illinois?
So the Medicaid population in Illinois for children is roughly around 3 million, and Medicaid covers about half of those kids.
Okay.
The expansion program under CHIP covers thousands and thousands of kids, so if it were to expire, it would be detrimental to our system.
So what should the average person know about the CHIP program in terms of why it's so important that this be continued? Jenny?
CHIP is and really ensures access to health care for children in Illinois, and it certainly serves a really important safety net. So, you know, those visits to go see your doctor, the immunizations, your back-to-school visits, all those screenings and developmental checks that pediatricians do are really important in early childhood, and certainly CHIP ensures that children continue to have access for those. If the program does expire, we're really facing, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids being kicked off insurance abruptly with really no continued access. Certainly these families are not able to afford private insurance on the marketplace or in other localities or through their employer. So it's really important that we continue to make sure that these children are receiving all the health care that they need.
Well, Debbie, it's no mystery that the state of Illinois is not doing well in terms of its budgeting and monetary concerns. Does it concern you, or how much does it concern you, that Congress hasn't acted yet to extend funding for CHIP beyond the end of this week?
So I think that CHIP provides our state with a way for our children to get the services they need. And when those services aren't available, that it impacts other parts of the system. They end up in more expensive settings like hospital emergency rooms. And we are already a beleaguered, financially unstable state. So the expiration of CHIP would not help Illinois at all.
Is this a common thing, Jenny, that Congress would wait until a bill or a program is about to expire in order to renew funding?
With the each CHIP reauthorization, we've seen it delayed further and further, and certainly within this current political environment, you know, at the beginning of the month, we certainly felt that CHIP was going to be renewed in a timely manner, and we're feeling fairly positive about it. But, you know, certainly with the new Graham-Cassidy bill and focus on both repeal and replacement of the ACA and changes in the Medicaid program as a whole that are proposed in that legislation, we continue to be concerned about what will happen if CHIP is not renewed by Saturday. We have not seen really any indication from either our state or other states about what their plans are moving forward, but we certainly know that these funds are really needed to continue these programs and to keep children insured.
Has this been a concern in years past? So let's say when CHIP was set to expire, the last time it was set to expire, was Congress quick about making sure that it was renewed, or was there a delayed time?
We've never seen it renewed past the deadline that it's been needed to be renewed. It's always been a fairly bipartisan effort. We've seen both Republicans and Democrats really rally around the ability to keep children insured and covered. CHIP is a program that's generally considered to work really well within states and is fairly popular that way. So although we may have seen it be pushed into September for that renewal, we have not really quite seen it go this close to the wire before. So, you know, at this point, it's kind of anyone's best guess about what will happen if it's not renewed by Saturday.
So no doubt Congress has a very, very full plate right now. We've got the ACA repeal efforts underway, hurricane relief efforts underway. I know the concern is that this may slip through the cracks with everything else going on. Debbie, do we have any Illinois lawmakers that are working on your behalf to make sure that CHIP continues?
I think as a population of service providers and legislators, we are working to try to get recognition that this is happening and we are really close to the deadline. So I believe we do have lawmakers working for that.
We should note that we've reached out to the Illinois Department of Health Care and Family Services, or HFS, to ask them what will happen to these 180,000 children covered by CHIP in Illinois if the funding does not get renewed by September 30th. They haven't responded to us by the time of this interview was recorded, so if we get a response, we'll make sure to tweet that out. So if you follow us at the 21st Show and have it available, we'll have it available on our website, their response, at 21stshow.org. Jenny, can you help me understand the distribution of children covered by CHIP throughout Illinois? Like, are there mostly kids in urban areas? Are they mostly in rural areas?
Kids covered under CHIP do tend to cluster in certain areas, so it's not necessarily evenly spread throughout the state. They tend to be in, you know, the Chicago and surrounding areas, you know, Peoria and the surrounding areas. They tend to center more within city centers around there. That isn't to say that there aren't CHIP kids in every county, but, you know, when we look at the majorities and where those kids lie, they do tend to be surrounded kind of by urban areas. So, you know, we always get really concerned when immunization rates start to lag in those areas, you know, making them prone to vaccine preventable illness. So we're always really concerned when CHIP isn't able to pay for those vaccines, that, you know, making sure that they continue to get their catch-ups at various locations.
As I mentioned just a little bit ago, Debbie, there's a lot of other things going on in the world that Congress has to be paying attention to as well. But can you give us a sense of the urgency? What is it that makes it so important that CHIP be put on the front burner as well?
Well, I believe it's access to health care. I mean, we have thousands and thousands of kids and families that won't have access to basic health care if CHIP expires. And I think that is the most important thing people need to understand. That puts a burden on every other social system that we have.
And there are several other programs, aren't there, Jenny, that will affect children and families that are set to expire this week?
Yes. Also, the authorization for home visiting funding is set up to expire at the end of the month, too. So we see a lot of activity in terms of various projects that are federally funded that are kind of set up to expire. So we certainly hope that Congress will take these up before the end of the week.
And while we're on the topic of health care, if we can shift gears for just a moment here, Debbie, and explain how these latest efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare, this Graham-Cassidy bill, how would that likely play out here in Illinois?
Well, Illinois would stand to lose a lot of funding if this bill is enacted. And the biggest thing is it would go to a block grant in 2020, with the block grant then expiring in 2026, with no assurances that then the federal government would be able to have a funding stream to renew those services, because it wouldn't be in the baseline federal budget. So Illinois could stand to lose billions of dollars in funding for health care.
So just 2020 to 2026, and what would happen
and then it goes
after
away.
20?
Yeah, it becomes per capita, and as the per capita doesn't keep pace with the actual projected Medicaid spend, you'll see states having to, and especially Illinois, they'll have to determine whether or not people, they'll have to cut eligibility, cut access to care in order to fund the program.
And as you mentioned, that lack of access to health care then sort of has a ripple effect on everything else.
Absolutely.
Jenny, what's the position of the American Academy of Pediatrics on this Graham-Cassidy bill?
We're certainly opposed. We've been opposed to those efforts, all those efforts related to repeal of the ACA, especially related and especially concerning those issues around the changes in Medicaid. So, one of the things that we were surprised at with the initial round of legislation was the coupling of Medicaid to the repeal of the ACA. And certainly these changes, as described around block granting, are especially concerning for all states. And we know that from other states that they just simply do not keep up with the cost. So if there is something, a natural disaster like a hurricane or something like that, where the system is stressed and people might lose their jobs and there's more kids or adults on Medicaid, then we're still receiving the same amount of money, and states won't necessarily be able to continue to provide that same level of coverage. So we have been opposed, and on a national level and state level have been working to energize our members to call and really reach out and talk on behalf of children and the effects that these bills will have on their health care.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that the funding is going to be inadequate.
Yes, the Graham-Cassidy funding proposals certainly are worrisome in terms of being able to keep up with Medicaid costs, not only in Illinois, but in most states.
But those who support it say it will give states more freedom. No?
Certainly they do suggest that. One of the concerning efforts of that is that there's really no specific requirements within the legislation to protect children and adults, especially those with pre-existing conditions. So, we've certainly seen that play out in the popular media where, the ACA has lots of components that protect, lifetime caps and things like that. And, it's not unusual for children that have a heart condition or children that are born early in a neo-intensive care unit to hit, proposed lifetime max pretty quickly, and then would certainly be on their own for the rest of their lives for health insurance. So, the Medicaid components to that are, certainly related to block granting. And, although Illinois is very conservative in their Medicaid spending, we know that, it's only a small, disaster or a job loss to hit a family and need that access to care. And, especially within the current components for the current payment schedules for Medicaid in Illinois, we just certainly wouldn't be able to keep up with those costs.
What are you hearing from families, parents?
So we deal most directly with providers. We know that our members who see children and families every day are always concerned about their ability to cover costs and to be able to access timely insurance. And certainly our members are very concerned about those kids being able to access all the care that they need, whether it's preventative care or things like developmental screening or follow-up or referrals or things like that. Those families are worried that they won't be able to cover the cost if this program goes away.
And Debbie, do you have any suggestions or ideas about how this should be formulated? I mean, what is the process like from where you get to where you are to where we get to the halls of Congress and say, all right, here's what we think needs to be done? How much lobbying or how many ears do you have at your disposal to make sure that the concerns of Illinois are being addressed?
So I think as a provider community, to echo her sentiments earlier, we have done a lot of outreach to our federal lawmakers. We have engaged in social media campaigns, trying to raise the level of awareness. I think that we could do more, absolutely. And it takes everybody, not just us, but family members as well. I think that people aren't noticing what's going on because of everything else that has been happening in the country in the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely the more voices that we have raising this to the attention of lawmakers, the better.
Well, we appreciate you both for being with us as well. Jenny Pinkwater, the Executive Director of the Illinois Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and Debbie McCarroll, Senior Policy Analyst with the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Coming up, new research from the University of Illinois finds that some kids could have picky eating built into their genes. We speak with two of the authors of that study and ask, what can parents of picky eaters do to encourage their little ones to be more adventurous during mealtime? That's coming up next on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer in for Nyla Boodoo today. For parents of young children, mealtime can either be a very pleasant experience or an extremely frustrating one, depending on, of course, whether or not you have a picky eater. There are tons of parenting blogs, books, and online forums where desperate parents turn to for advice to help their child become a more adventurous eater at mealtime. So today we take a step back and ask, what's the science behind picky eating? A new study from the University of Illinois explores the role of nature versus nurture when it comes to picky eating. It's published in the Journal of Nutrigenics and Nutrigenomics. We'll tweet out a link to the study if you follow us at 21st Show. We'll also have it available on our website, 21stshow.org. I'm joined now by two of the authors of that study. Natasha Cole is a doctoral student in the Division of Nutritional Sciences, and Soo-Yun Lee is a professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us on the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
So help me understand how this study began. How did we start studying the science of picky eating in children?
So this started with our interest in differences in taste perception. We know that differences in the ability to taste is based on genetics, but what is unclear is whether these same genes are related to picky eating behavior. So the goal of the study then was to investigate the relationship between genes related to taste and in a sample of preschool age children.
And you had more than, 150 preschoolers?
Mm-hmm.
Age 2 to 4?
Mm-hmm.
And what were your first findings?
So what we found was the two genes that, interestingly enough, were both related to bitter taste perception. These two genes were associated with picky eating in children. So this suggests that children who are more bitter sensitive may be more likely of being a picky eater.
And do you have any insights as to what might have caused that sensitivity to that bitter taste?
There are some research to suggest that these genes just basically make you more sensitive to being able to taste these bitter compounds that are in foods. And some foods, food examples would be broccoli, Brussels sprouts.
And so do you use that information? Like, how do you define what picky eating is? Is it based on that bitter criterion?
We define picky eating based on how the parents perceive the behavior. So basically how we measured picky eating was we asked parents a series of questions regarding their child's eating behaviors. And we asked them, some examples of these questions are, does your child refuse vegetables? Does your child eat a limited variety of foods? And we asked parents to rate how frequently these behaviors occur on a scale of 1 to 5. So 1 being never and 5 always. And that's how we measured picky eating behavior.
And in that group of 150, how many were picky?
Well, we did. Quite a few of them were. I would say about a quarter of them were picky, according to our, a little bit more than a third, for depending on if they had limited dietary variety. But it was a significant amount that were picky.
Sue, this topic is of interest. I'm a mom myself, and I know how difficult it can sometimes be to have a picky eater at the table. So for myself and for other parents of young children who blame ourselves for a child's picky eating tendencies, what do we know from previous studies about the role of nature versus nurture when it comes to having a picky eater at home?
So there isn't a lot of research out there on the nature component. This is why we wanted to do this study. The majority of research that's out there is more on the nurture component or the parent side of things. There really isn't too much that has been done looking at the genetic determinants of what may be behind picky eating. Really, other than a couple other studies that may have investigated if it's hereditary or not, mm-hmm. no research has been done on specific genes.
If I may add, prior to Natasha's research, we had research that really did look into the nurture part, the environmental and the caregiver part of picky eating. And also going really back to the first round of research where we were trying to define picky eater, we had people answer concept about what they believe a picky eater would have, mm-hmm. either behavior or tendencies. And so going back to past research, looking into the nurture part, yes, there are some correlations that we saw with parenting styles and how they perceive their child as picky. And so most of the research in the literature, and including ours, our past research, we define picky eater by the caregiver's perception, subjective evaluation okay. of their criteria of picky eating.
So is it possible then that if the caregiver has a stricter definition of picky eating than maybe a researcher or even another caregiver, then the child may or may not actually be a picky eater? It's just really based on what the caregiver's perception of that picky eating is. Does that make sense?
Yes, correct. And we show that in our to a certain degree in our past research. When we asked the caregiver at a child care environment versus the parent as the caregiver to evaluate the same child, and not so surprisingly, parents perceive their child as more picky than the caregiver at the child care environment. So yes, you are correct. It is very subjective to the caregiver's perception and the criterion.
But when a parent hears that their child may be genetically predisposed to picky eating, is there sometimes this sort of throw up my hands reaction? Well, now what am I supposed to do? Is this something that kids can outgrow? Can we change the environment, change their behaviors, change the introduction of foods to make them less picky as they age?
So this is something that we are looking at. We're looking at, you know, the interaction between nature and nurture, and genetics most definitely does not equal destiny. And I think some great examples of this would be beer and coffee. bitter, very bitter foods, but yet adults love them. And most certainly you can learn to like the bitter foods. And what we're trying to find is that even with children who may be predisposed to dislike these foods, they can learn to like them through parent feeding practices.
So what,
right. You cannot change the genetic code, obviously, but I agree with what Natasha said in that you can most definitely learn to approve and appreciate a whole slew of different types of flavor. Even if bitter is innate dislike perception, we learn to like it.
So, Sue, between the two genes that are related to the bitter taste and then adding in the picky eating component as reported by the caregiver, what are some other questions your research group is trying to address about this whole picky eating process?
So some of the things that we're looking at, again, I mentioned the nature component is looking at various genes. We're not just investigating genes related to taste perception. We're also looking at genes related to temperament and appetite. And then for the nurture component, I'm looking specifically at how responsive a parent feeding environment is during the mealtime. So these are practices that encourage a child's ability to recognize when they're full and when they're hungry. It's less controlling. The child is more of control of what they eat and how much they eat. And then we're also, again, looking at the interaction between nature and nurture. So while a child may be genetically predisposed, what is the influence of parenting on top of that? So can we change or can we alter a children's eating behaviors, even though from a biological standpoint, they're more predisposed to hate certain foods?
This is really fascinating research, and I ask these questions as an interviewer and as a mom, because I go back and forth sometimes between saying, well, this is what I made and that's what you're going to eat, and then saying, well, perhaps there are things that I don't like, so maybe there are things that they don't like, and maybe I should change the meal accordingly. Would you recommend trying to change that way, or is it just let the child eat what's on the table?
So I'm a huge proponent of the concept of one family, one meal. Everyone should be eating the same thing. And adults, there should be a division of responsibility during mealtimes, in that adults are responsible for buying the food and preparing the food in a tasty and healthful manner, and then setting very structured mealtimes without distractions. But yet it's the child's responsibility for whether or not they want to eat what you've prepared and how much of it they want to eat. And I know this is easier said than done, because oftentimes parents with picky eaters, they worry that their child is not going to eat enough. And so one of the things that happens is they short order cook for them, and they are willing to prepare whatever it is necessary to get the child to eat. But this can backfire and cause picky eating to be worse. So,
Sue, are you on the same page with that?
Yeah, so I would have to rely on the scientific evidence that's out there in the literature and also our future study. And what we're trying to do is to create a list of possible strategies and interventions that might be bringing in a positive mealtime setting. And there are some general strategies that are reported in the literature, such as more exposure to get overcome the food neophobia, as well as Natasha mentioned, to have the kids be in control of how much they eat and have that internal satiety cue in place, intact, while they're growing up, and not override that. But what we really want to do eventually, especially with the findings from Natasha's study, is to really specialize and customize to a specific group of kids that are showing distinct features of picky eating. So, yeah, sometimes it might be better if we were to customize the food for them because they have these specific needs, maybe related to genetics, maybe related to their behavioral aspects. Maybe, as Natasha mentioned, we want the whole family to have the same food, and that is the expectation we create. And that actually creates a better mealtime environment for the kids in that family. But it really does depend on the kid and the environment and the interaction, and that's what we're trying to elucidate more specifically. So not just the general, okay, this is how you're going to go about it, but really what we're finding is that picky eating is not just one size fits all.
That makes sense. Natasha, the study looked at preschoolers starting at age two, mm-hmm. but when a baby goes from, you know, being on formula or breast milk to age two, there's still a gap there from when they start having cereal and introducing those first bits of baby food. And I know in my own experience, I would get frustrated sometimes because we tend to gravitate toward sweet things because we know that's what the kid's going to eat. And so my husband would always give the fruits first, then I'd be stuck trying to introduce the vegetables.
Right.
And my mom would take a little finger full of ice cream and say, oh, but she likes it. Do we predispose kids to their idea of what good food is even before age two?
So that's kind of where the gap in the literature is. We know a lot about children 2 to 5. And then during that transition period, 12 to 24 months, when they're moving from a primarily milk-based diet to foods that the rest of the family is eating, this is where the gap is. We don't really have a lot of research as to the types of foods that they're being introduced, the specific order that they should be introduced, and the influence that it may have on their eating behaviors later on. Some of our work right now is actually looking at some of these younger children. Picky eating behaviors can start before age two, but I can't answer your question in terms of we don't know.
Got it. So we know we short order cooking is probably to be limited or eliminated. Kids should also be able to choose how much of their foods they're going to eat. I chuckle because I was at a parenting seminar once and the lecturer said no child has ever starved in the presence of food, meaning if they just eat what's in front of them or not eat it, eventually they'll get hungry enough to eat it.
Right.
But any other advice before we close that we can give to parents of picky eaters and how they can muddle through?
I guess one final one would be to be patient and try. I mean, this is, for the most part, a normal stage of development for most children. And so to avoid pressuring them during mealtimes, it's really important to have a positive feeding environment. And that doesn't just mean, you know, a distraction-free environment. It also means a pleasant place, so the parents need to almost back off.
Some great advice.
I would add on to that even a positive reward type of strategy, if you eat your broccoli, you can get your dessert, that's a positive reward type of strategy, can backfire in that the kid has broccoli as the bad thing to overcome mm-hmm. to get the good thing, the dessert at the end. So really having some options, perhaps offer, if you want, obviously, the vegetable to be consumed, then have carrots, broccoli, and green beans, and then separate them out and say, oh, why don't you choose out of the three what you would like to have?
And, that's a good idea.
You know, you have the comfort as a parent that they're eating vegetable, and the kids, especially in that age of two when they're exerting independence, feel confident and good that they made the choice, and also they own it and to hopefully consume all of it.
Mm-hmm. It is fascinating research and wonderful to speak to you both. Natasha Cole, Soo-Yun Lee, thank you both for being with us on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo today. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention describes insufficient sleep as a public health epidemic. In fact, an estimated 50 to 70 million U.S. adults have either sleep or wakefulness disorders that can affect their daily functioning, like driving, overall mental health, long-term well-being, even depression, stress, type 2 diabetes, weight gain, and even Alzheimer's. Dr. Sarah Zalek is director of Illinois Neurological Institute Sleep Clinic, and she joins us today. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Zalek. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, Yvonne.
If you would clarify for us, just as we get started, so many misconceptions, I think, exist in the world about how much sleep is enough sleep. Does it vary from person to person, or is it that standard 8 hours that we really all need to get?
It does vary a little from person to person, but in general, human adults have evolved to need about 8 hours. And when you study human adults in a laboratory setting, for example, 8 hours is about what all the subjects have gotten in a setting that allows them to sleep naturally. Now, in reality, many people are really fully rested feeling with 7 to 8 hours. So we kind of say 7 to 8 is the healthy amount of sleep. Most people are fine in that range. There's a lot of variability in how people tolerate differences from that. Some people feel they need more to feel fully refreshed, and there are a lot of people who feel they don't need that much.
What about quality of sleep? So let's say I get 8 hours of sleep, but I don't wake up feeling refreshed, and actually I've woken up a few times in the night and I feel like I could probably stay in bed another hour or so to really get that refreshed feeling.
So, yeah, quality of sleep is a very significant problem for some people. If you feel like you've slept 7 or 8 hours and, well, you know you've slept 7 or 8 hours and you feel like you haven't slept well, there might be something wrong with the quality of your sleep. I think of sleepiness as coming from kind of four different buckets. One is quantity, which we've already talked about. The next is quality of sleep, like you just mentioned, and that includes things like sleep apnea, stopping breathing in sleep, or other sleep disorders, or environmental sleep disturbances. Poor quality of sleep comes in a lot of different packages. If you've got a sleep timing problem that doesn't let you sleep when you mean to be sleeping at that time of the day or night, that can be a reason for tiredness or sleepiness. And then if you have an increased overall sleep drive, so if you have a good amount of sleep, the right quality of sleep and the right timing of sleep, but you're still sleepy, then it might not be the quality of your sleep at all. It might actually be an increased drive to sleep because you might be sick. For example, when we have the flu, we all feel more sleepy. Other illnesses can cause that, but so can some medicines. And then, of course, sleep disorders such as narcolepsy and others that can make people very sleepy by nature.
Got it. So before we talk about how to address some of these concerns and make sure you get the appropriate length and quality of sleep, let's talk about what happens if you don't get the appropriate length and quality of sleep. The CDC says sleep is just as important as diet and exercise.
It is. And in fact, the National Sleep Foundation says sleep is just as important as diet and exercise, only easier. So if you can prioritize it, it's really a great tool for your overall health. A lot of things happen when we don't sleep. And there's sort of the obvious thing that many of us recognize. If we don't sleep enough, we feel sleepy. We feel like, wow, I could just put my head down and take a nap. But sleep deprivation can also make us feel crabby, inattentive, and for kids, for example, they can be particularly hyperactive. So some kids with ADHD, for example, haven't had enough sleep, and they don't look sleepy like an adult might. So sleep deprivation causes a lot of symptoms. One of the important things to recognize is that our performance, both cognitively, our thinking performance, and motor performance, our ability to carry out motor tasks, physical tasks, goes down even if we're not sleepy, if we hadn't had enough sleep. So for those of us who get 7 or 8 hours and feel good, that's great. And remember, there are some people who can feel good with less sleep, but performance might go down. So if you get less than 6 hours of sleep, even if you don't feel sleepy, if you're one of those people who feels pretty refreshed with not a lot of sleep, mm-hmm. you're still going to have some impairment. Everybody under 6 hours of sleep on a regular basis is impaired in their ability to perform and react and remember, even if they don't feel it. So sleep deprivation or not getting enough quality or quantity of sleep can cause us to be sleepy, tired, irritable, but it can also change performance.
And can it also lead to issues like depression or anxiety?
Absolutely. So those things are very fragile in our biology in the first place. So if we have a tendency toward depression or anxiety, they tend to be amplified if we don't have enough sleep. And if we don't sleep enough, even if we don't have another tendency toward those things, we can still develop depression or low mood or anxiety to the point that many people are misdiagnosed with depression or anxiety who are sleep deprived. And in fact, if we would address the sleep problem, those symptoms would go away. Similarly, memory and thinking and learning go down mm-hmm. if we don't get enough sleep. So whereas, again, you might not be fully sleepy, but if you haven't had enough sleep, you're not going to be able to learn or remember as well. And so many people with either sleep deprivation or particularly obstructive sleep apnea, which is that common disorder of stopping breathing repeatedly in sleep, have actually been misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's disease because they don't remember very well. That is treatable with getting enough sleep or treating sleep apnea will help the memory get back to baseline and become normal again, which is separate from your mention of the risk of Alzheimer's disease in people who don't sleep well, which is a different issue.
And what is that connection since we're on that path?
That's a very interesting connection. There's been some suggestion that not getting enough sleep may make Alzheimer's disease more likely, and a recent study actually demonstrated some of the biochemistry of that. So they took some healthy subjects and divided them into two groups and had one group sleep a normal amount, and the other group were sleep deprived for one night. And they noticed when they measured their cerebral spinal fluid, the fluid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord, mm-hmm. they noticed that there was an increase in amyloid beta, which is a protein in the brain associated with Alzheimer's disease. So one night doesn't cause Alzheimer's disease, but we can measure a chemical that goes up after one night of sleep deprivation. That's one of the things we see in Alzheimer's disease many years later. In that same group, they measured after 1 week of sleep deprivation an increase in a protein called tau, which is another one of the abnormal findings in Alzheimer's later in life. So there are a couple of measures recently that have been shown that with acute sleep deprivation, one night or 1 week, there are increases in some of the chemicals that we see later on in Alzheimer's disease. So there's probably some biological link between sleep deprivation and Alzheimer's disease for some people.
But this area of research is relatively new, so there may be some time before we can fully discover exactly what the links are and how to prevent them.
Very much so. But in the meantime, we should all get a good night's sleep.
Now, what if you simply can't? So let's say I'm the mom of a newborn and the baby wakes up every 2 to 3 hours because I have to do a feeding or during the day. You know, there's that sleeping, waking sleep when the baby sleeps. Is it okay to chunk your time and sleep when the baby sleeps, for example, if I'm a newborn mom? Or is it more important to hire somebody so that I can get that? And I know sometimes hiring isn't a possibility also.
Yeah, if you have the luxury of hiring somebody and not having to sleep when the baby sleeps, that's great. But for most of the world, we have to sleep when the baby sleeps. And in those situations, when you're a mom of a new baby, sleep when the baby sleeps is a great principle. So if you really do not have an opportunity to sleep a continuous night of sleep at night, then sleeping in the biggest chunks possible that add up to 7 or 8 hours is a great idea. And I see that, of course, in new parents, but also in people who have shift working jobs where they rotate their shifts, or they might work a stable night shift, for example, and have family responsibilities in the day and not be able to find a continuous 7 or 8 hours sleep period. So they sleep in the biggest, fewest chunks of sleep possible for the best sleep if you can't get an full night of sleep.
When it comes to weight gain and those sorts of body improvement issues, I always assumed when I would hear people say, well, I know it's because I don't get enough sleep, I always assumed that it was because you're eating to stay awake, because I've seen people do that. College students will do that. They'll munch on something while they study. People at a desk job that may have to work overnight for whatever reason will munch on something just to keep their attention span up. I understand that you can gain weight because you're eating extra to keep yourself awake, but how do you gain weight when you're not sleeping well?
Yeah, it turns out that not sleeping well or not sleeping enough is definitely associated with weight gain or difficulty losing weight. And we know that for several reasons. In not sleeping enough, there are a few things that happen. Yes, you might be increasing your calories. And yes, when you work at odd hours of the night, I work in a hospital, and so there's always delicious snacky food in the middle of the night in the hospital. But the eating patterns might change. But also, there are some hormonal levels that change in the body with sleep deprivation. There's a hormone called leptin, which makes us feel full, and that tends to go down if you're sleep deprived, and so you feel less full with the same amount of food. And there's a hormone called ghrelin that makes you feel hungry. If you're sleep deprived, that hormone goes up and makes you feel a little bit hungrier. So without really noticing that your belly is fuller than it would normally be, you might be increasing your food intake because you're less full and more hungry.
So it's not your imagination. Your hormones really are asking you to eat.
That's very true. And when if you're sleep deprived, you know, for those of us who've spent some nights working all night, and many people who've been studying all night or had babies up keeping us up at night, you know that your stomach feels funny in the middle of the night. Hunger and satiety vary with the day and the night cycle. And if you are awake during the time your body's meant to sleep, your stomach feels a little bit funny. And then if you've been awake for a long time, you might not be as hungry as you normally would at the right hour. So there's a lot of interplay there. One of the other interesting things is obstructive sleep apnea, which is a disorder of repeatedly stopping breathing in sleep, which then arouses the patient throughout the night, sometimes hundreds of times a night. So sleep is not continuous, even if they have a lot of total sleep. The sleep quality is terrible. In those patients, similar to being fully sleep deprived, leptin and ghrelin change in a way that makes people less full and more hungry. And in sleep apnea, you're also very tired. Many people are very tired and don't spend the same amount of energy during the daytime exercising and moving and burning calories. Even if it's not a matter of not going to the gym, which many people don't have the energy to do if they have sleep apnea, very often they're just spending fewer calories walking, moving, and just moving around during the daytime.
What are some strategies that I can employ today to make sure I get an adequate and quality amount of sleep?
There are a lot of strategies to help assure that you get the right amount and quality of sleep, one of which is to keep a fairly regular dedicated sleep period time on your clock. So go to bed at about the same time each night, and more importantly, wake at about the same time each day, so that your circadian rhythm, your internal clock, allows you the best opportunity to sleep, because it wants you to sleep at about the same time each night and be awake during the day.
But my body wants to sleep longer on Saturdays.
Yes, you know, that's something called social jet lag. That's a really, really common problem in the U.S. because we tend to short ourselves on sleep on weeknights, Yvonne, if you want to sleep in on Saturdays. It's very common that we short ourselves on sleep on weeknights, and then we sleep a little longer, and we might even go to sleep later on Friday and Saturday nights because we're socializing or staying up watching Netflix or whatever we do, and then sleep later in the morning. But the body then starts to adjust as if we'd taken a trip to the West Coast, and it's a little harder to wake up on Monday. Mm-hmm. So that social jet lag is not just increasing difficulty getting to work on Mondays or school, but it also increases the risk of heart disease and decreases mood and several other things. So
I'll bet you're going to say no laptop either.
No laptop either. You don't want to curtail your sleep. So not just setting a time for sleep to sort of happen at about the same time each night, but then really dedicate sleep to that time without doing other things in that time or space. So your bed should be for sleep or intimacy. I tell all my patients, if you're not sleeping or getting lucky, get out of bed. And that means no telephone, no laptop, no television, no lying awake thinking about the meaning of the universe or what's important in your life. Those should all be done outside of your bed. When you get into bed, you should focus on a happy, pleasant, relaxing thought. And when your mind distracts you with all the busyness of your life and things, if you can't get back to a relaxing thought, get up and read if it feels like you haven't been able to sleep for 20 minutes or so that you don't lie in bed for a long time. And when you're sleepy, reading in the other room or maybe doing a puzzle, then go back to bed. But don't get up and do physical activity or use electronics. You really just want to do something quietly and return to bed if you can't sleep. And caffeine is a very significant part of our culture. It's a wonderful drug, but it also, even a single dose of caffeine for some of us in the morning can affect sleep at night. So if you have trouble sleeping, really think about eliminating caffeine completely or reducing it sufficiently.
So I'm going to reduce or eliminate my caffeine. I'm going to keep the bedroom for sleeping and intimacy, and I'm going to make sure that I get adequate exercise and eat healthfully. All that sound good?
Exactly. That sounds like a great idea. See, it's just as important as diet and exercise, only easier.
Dr. Sarah Zalek, Director of Illinois Neurological Institute Sleep Clinic, thank you so much for being with us on the 21st.
My pleasure. Thank you, Yvonne.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.